Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
It's John Justin Kaufman. It's got such a Schoolhouse Rock kind of vibe to it. That's why I think I like it.
I hear that too.
Yeah, and of all the theme songs, and I love all the shows' different theme songs, this is the one that always grabs my attention, mostly because I think, I'm guessing it's, maybe it's a bassoon, where it's like, ba-bow, bow, bow. Whatever that is. Al, if you're the music person, you know what that sound is, that honking sound? Sounds like a duck, like they're squeezing a duck at the end of the song?
It's definitely a wind instrument.
Ba-da, ba-da,
I actually suck with wind instruments. I can never tell them apart, so don't turn to me on that.
That was kind of a pun, because it suck.
Oh, that is so good.
That was good. That was you. That was all you. Justin Kaufman in for John Williams today till 3 o'clock. John will be back this week, right? Is he back later this week?
Hopefully, yeah, Thursday.
Hopefully. Mm-hmm. Which is perfect, because if I'm not mistaken, that's closer to your birthday.
Oh, my God. How do you know all these fun facts?
You know what? This is what happens when you get 2 days off to prep for the John Williams show, is that I'm fully immersed in the world of Elif.
Wow. Yeah.
No, but it's on the fridge.
Yeah, it is on the fridge. It's cute that that Marlene does that.
Yeah, she puts the birthdays the month, and I think yours is June 7th, June 6th?
Mm-hmm, 7th.
So there you go. So John will be back for your birthday. That's what
That's
matters.
That's hilarious. Thank you. Yeah.
It would be kind of disrespectful if it were a sub-host, someone filling in on your birthday, right?
Because they wouldn't bring me a present or a card and a cupcake like John does every year. Hint, hint, John.
I was going to say, I'll help you out. I'll bring a present.
We got a full house today. Lauren. Hi, Lauren. How are you?
Hello, Justin.
All right. So we got a lot to do today. We got some fun stuff to talk about. I want to talk about, obviously, the White Sox yesterday had their big draft, and they drafted the first. Did you know this, Elif? Lauren, you might know this. It is MLB history. The White Sox made MLB history yesterday. The guy they picked, Andrew Vaughn, out of California, is the first right-handed first baseman to ever go in the top five in MLB draft history.
I did not know that.
How about that, huh?
I think I did see something about that yesterday.
The reason is, and we'll talk to Kevin Powell about this later, the reason is that baseball likes the left-handed first basemen. Because
they like a lot of left-handers.
Yeah, I think it has to do with that I was reading that it's just more natural. They can tag quicker. So a lot of right-handed batters are, when they make it to right-handed first basemen, make it to the big leagues, it's almost an anomaly. The White Sox have a long-standing tradition. Of course, their first baseman right now, Jose Abreu, but also Paul Konerko. Paulie Konerko is a right-hander. So the idea that the White Sox continue their tradition of a right-handed first baseman and make MLB history, it's worth something. We'll talk about that coming up later in the show towards the end. We could talk about Ed Burke, Alderman Ed Burke. No, there's nothing really to talk about.
He doesn't like to talk back, so why should we talk about it?
He gave a no comment, and this isn't necessarily when, you know, to go in front of the judge, and he pleaded not guilty. That's pretty much it. This is going to be a media circus. Maybe not as big as Blagojevich, because Blagojevich was a talker. When you're a talker and you want to talk about what's the case in front of you, the media loves it. And our attention goes haywire. We're all over it. But when you're a defendant who doesn't talk, maybe just has a lawyer's talk or gives a no comment and goes about their day, it has less gasoline. So maybe that's what Alderman Ed Burke is doing. The calls for his resignation are still there. The mayor today, again, saying, hey, step down. But to be fair, there's nothing in the city council ordinances, rules, and regulations that says while you're on trial, before you're convicted, you have to step down.
Right.
That would be just a moral or ethical or fall into the category of the right thing to do. But for Ed Burke, there's nothing on the law. There's nothing on the books that says he has to do that. And, you know, we do live in a country where you're innocent until proven guilty. So But it'll be interesting to see if the pressure mounts on Alderman Burke and if he decides that the public spotlight, I can't even get through the sentence. He's not going to. I was about to say, you know, he really cares what people think about him, and he really wants to get away from the limelight and really enjoy his time. No, that's not the Alderman Ed Burke we know. So I think he'll stick around and be the 14th Ward Alderman for a couple more, I don't even know, council meetings. Let's just put it there, right? We could talk about Stanley Tigerman. Stanley Tigerman, the longtime architect in town. Are you familiar at all, Elif and Lauren? You're younger.
Just from what I read today.
he was a big architect in the 1970s. He came up, you're familiar with Mies van der Rohe. So the buildings that are along the lakefront, the sort of black box buildings that are like kind of on North Lakeshore Drive, they're very pronounced 1950s. They're just like black boxes.
Yep.
That's Mies van der Rohe.
What about this building?
Is this a Mies van der Rohe building? I'm not sure if it is.
Right?
But here's the issue. And this is, I think Stanley Tigerman, who died yesterday at the age of 89, and he's really an icon. He's a legend. He did the Holocaust Museum in Skokie. He did the Anti-Cruelty Society building on LaSalle Street. He did, list goes on and on. I mean, he did the Seminary Co-op bookstore in Hyde Park. Anything that's sort of, it really is in the fabric of neighborhoods and downtown. You can find Stanley Tigerman's work. But in the mid-70s, he was part of a crew. He worked with and under Mies van der Rohe and came to Chicago. Or he's from Chicago, but when he came to prominence in Chicago, he and six other architects, they formed this group called the Chicago Seven. And it was to push back on the copycats of Mies van der Rohe. Because as he put, and I read all this stuff about the quotes, he wrote, or he was quoted as saying, when people get off the airplane in Chicago, you don't want them to think this is just one big strip mall. And they were really pushing architects, because architects at the time were like, we're just going to do big boxes in the city, big black boxes. They're going to be everywhere. And he and his fellow architects, they pushed back and said, we need a bold, we need style, we need to be out of the box. We need to do things that people don't expect from us with our architecture in Chicago. And that's what we're going to push back against the architects for, just kind of cut and copy architecture that was happening in that time. And it has a profound effect. That pushback, just that scrutiny, that bravado, that boldness to say, you know, flip his nose to the architectural community at that time. I do think that it shepherded in new architects and new thinking about the buildings around us. And now you look around and Chicago is exactly what they were looking for. A mix and mash and bold, and the new stuff that comes up is colorful and interesting. And that's the kind of architecture, if you take the architecture tour, that you see in Chicago and downtown Chicago and also in the neighborhoods and other places. And that was because, and I firmly believe Stanley Tigerman is the godfather of this, but he pushed back at the architectural community to say, we do not want the cookie cutter. This is not your New York City or other urban landscapes. We want something different.
Right.
So he was a profound thinker and a great quote maker. We could sit here for 2 hours and we could play Stanley Tigerman quotes. He was such a eloquent speaker on behalf of his love of architecture. So Stanley Tigerman, rest in peace. And then, you know, we also could talk about softball as the WGN radio team, Elif. And I know this is near and dear to your heart because I've been trying to recruit you to play.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We belong to the 16-inch media league, the Cup League, named after Irv Kupcinet. And last night we played the Tribune. Now I couldn't play. I'm the captain. I'm the coach. And I'm a very motivational coach. I'm a yeller. I get excited when there's a play in the on the diamond, a defensive play. I'm like the hype man.
But you don't participate?
No, I do participate. Okay. I play all over the diamond. I'm this close. George and the 16-inch Hall of Fame people say if I keep up my championship caliber, because I've won 3 championships now, that I could be possibly a candidate for the 16-inch Softball Hall of Fame. I'm too young right now.
Okay.
But I'm bringing that, the little quick backstory, their GM didn't have a team in the 16-inch league. They played 12-inch and they disbanded a couple years ago. And I've been working nights. I worked on the download for a long time. And then I moved to Cochrane Show. And when I was there, I was like, oh, my nights are open. So last year I played on a different team. I just kind of Kevin Duranted it. went in and played on a different team, and we won the championship. So it was very salty. Everyone was salty about it. And so this year, I went to Todd, and everyone said, you know, we should have our own WGN team. So last night, we played game two. We lost the first game on a walk-off, which was disappointing, but it was spring training. You got to get to know all your players. And last night, I wasn't there. Pete Zimmerman wasn't there. A lot of players weren't there last night. And the team came through and beat the Chicago Tribune.
Wow.
9-8.
So who wasn't there last night so we can weed them out
for
the next
games? I wasn't there.
All right, so you won't be playing again.
Who else was not there? Joe Marino wasn't there. I'm trying to think of Adam Hogue is still rehabbing.
Okay.
But the star of the game, Ernie Skatton was the coach. You know, he does all the production work for us here at WGN. He was the interim coach. But the star of the game, Sam Panionovich,
who
was back in town. He's no longer working for WGN, but he still plays on the softball team. And he was in left field, caught a ball. Should have been a home run. This is what I've been told endlessly by everybody on the team.
Obviously, everyone agrees.
He caught the ball deep. No one thought he could get there. He got it. He caught it. And the runner tagged up from third, and he threw the runner out at home.
Wow. That's impressive.
A one-hop 16-inch softball from the fence, like a Sammy Sosa gun. And so that was the difference was 9-8. How about that, huh?
Awesome.
All right, we'll take a break here. 312-981-7200. We haven't had a chance to talk about the casino. Where do you want a Chicago casino? Mayor Lightfoot said today, you know what? I'm going to do a study. Once I have that study, I'll pick where it's at. But if you had a chance, if they called you up and said, oh, yeah, I'd like to ask you, where do you think a Chicago casino should be? Where would it be? Downtown? Navy Pier? The Spire Hole? That never got
What's
filled
the Spire
up.
Hole?
You know the Spire Hole? There is a massive hole, round hole. About 10 years ago, say maybe even longer now, 20 years ago, there were plans to build a spire that was going to be 120 stories. It's going to be the tallest building maybe in the world. And the investments fell through. They started the dig on it. So there is a big hole right at Lakeshore Drive and Navy Pier, right in that area. Right, we could see it from our windows. A big hole that is yet to be filled, that's still owned by the people who own the Spire building.
Huh.
So maybe we could just do a casino that goes down into the hole.
Yeah, you know? Underground.
Underground. Where do you think it should be? 312-981-7200. We'll do that next. Stay with us. It's John Williams' show here. I am Justin Kaufman. I'm in for John. 312-981-7200. Talking about the casino. Where should it be? 847 says, put the casino right at McCormick Place or on the near south side with shuttles right to it from McCormick Place. Let conventioneers spend all their money there. This is a no-brainer. And this is a great point that 847 brings up. And this is what I want to talk about. There are two different schools of thought when it comes to the casino. And we haven't really heard what Mayor Lightfoot thinks. Mayor Emanuel was on with us on Cochrane, and he made it very clear. He wanted it on the far south side on the old City Works property, close to Northwest Indiana, to try and draw the dollars from Indiana into Chicago. That's one thought, the idea that you put it maybe in an underdeveloped area. As J.B. Pritzker, the governor of Illinois, said, give it to an area of Chicago that's been left behind. That's one school of thought. And this is an idea that's really been pushed, this idea that put it down there by City Works, right where our U.S. Steel used to be, right down there by Pullman. That's one way to do it. But, there's another school of thought. And this person hit it right on the head, 847, that if you really think about a casino and the way that politicians talk about it, we're all, just watching the politics of this play out. But this is they keep calling it a revenue source. Why do they call it a revenue source? They call it a revenue source because you're not going to win. So you drop your money into the casino, and that money becomes part of the revenue that the state of Illinois and the city of Chicago and the other, I think there's another Cook County or McCormick Place, someone else is going to get the money too. Southworks. Thank you, 847. But the idea that you put this thing in a neighborhood or as Governor Pritzker said, a place that has been left behind, and maybe it's an impoverished neighborhood. Who's going to this casino? The people who live in that neighborhood. And it ultimately becomes a tax. And there are many people that say that this is just a way to take more money from black and brown communities in Chicago. So that really has to be thought about. So two different schools of thought. And you see 847 kind of pulls on the idea that who's this for? Is it for tourists and conventioneers, or is it for Chicago residents. And if it's for Chicago residents, it's just another tax. Leo, Leo, where should it be, buddy? Where do you think we should put it?
Well, since we already have an existing structure, we can put it in the
the east.
Old yep. McCormick place, because now you don't have to pay. You don't have to pay for engineering. You don't have to pay for development, and you can avoid some corruption charges by giving favoritism to certain contractors that would be bidding for the project.
Yeah, well, that's a great point, Leo. And my friend and architect critic Lee Bay had suggested that when this fight was 15 years ago, because that is a dormant building that just to keep up. Is unbelievable the amount of time. Thanks, Leo. That's a great idea.
Yep.
Let's do Bill. Bill, where do you think it should be, Bill?
Yeah, I was going along with the far southeast side there where the old U.S. Steel plant used to be at 79th and South Shore.
That's what I was thinking.
Along there, that way you would draw the Indiana crowd, the south end of the suburbs, and it's not that too far from downtown either. I mean, it's... And it's right off of not that far from the South Shore Country Club Park.
And they did such a build. They did such a tremendous job of repaving that area. If you've been over there in the last
10 years,
they extended Lakeshore Drive down. So you the infrastructure is there, but they're
right.
And you know you are in the same mindset as the former mayor, Mayor Manuel, who came on the show and said that should be the place. So,
well, I was just thinking place just where to build it, you know, and. It would help the whole city and help some of the whole south side, the whole southern suburb part, because that way you'd also draw traffic from Indiana.
Right, that's the idea.
Because they got the casinos over there where you get some of the people from Indiana.
Yeah, that's cool. Thanks, Bill.
Okay.
I like that. But the same thing. Someone just put areas should left behind, 630 says this, should benefit from a casino, but players don't want to go to no man's land to play. And I'm not saying I don't want to disparage Southworks as no man's land. But it is a bit of a fallacy to think that you're going to draw casino goers from across the border. I'm not sure if that's the way to think, but people are talking that way. Ken, where do you think, Ken? Ken, where do you
want to... Justin, how are you, Justin?
Hey, I'm good, bud. How about you?
All right. Listen, Brock's Candy, you remember the factory off of Eisenhower?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it should be right there. I don't know if it's still there, but...
Didn't they blow that up? Didn't they implode that? I feel like they imploded
it. Could be, but I thought that'd spot, be a great location anyway, because it's off the Eisenhower.
Yeah.
You get all the rich people coming in.
That's what you need for a casino, right?
That's right. You got to make money, you know, by the rich people. So have a good one.
Thanks, Ken. That's a good point. We're the rich people. 630 says you put it 10 feet from the conventioneers. You can also put it, let's see, someone's saying 773 Joliet Harris Casino is a good place where they put it in an underdeveloped area and it's not doing as well. That's what this person says. I don't know. 313 makes a good point. So this is their opinion, but not much ancillary economic development that's associated with casinos. So if you put a casino in, I think that's what the Joliet Harris idea was too. But if you put the casino in, the idea is that around it, a community is going to thrive. And I think that that's a little bit of a fallacy. That's what this texter is saying, that it wouldn't do much for a struggling neighborhood. People go in, they go out, they're not going other places. So yeah, some great places. Okay, so coming up, Adam Strauss is going to join us. Adam is has a one-person show called The Mushroom Cure. And this is a continuation, Ella, of the conversation that John had with Michael Pollan about psychedelic mushrooms. Michael Pollan, great mind. He wrote the book about it, and he kind of described going through the trip. In this one-man show, which is getting great reviews, and it was at the New York Fringe, it was a hit on Off-Broadway New York. This is a story about Adam's mental illness. He's got OCD. And he tries everything, this, that, and whatever, to try and cope with it and to deal with the symptoms. And he lands on, after studying, he lands on psychedelics. He lands on mushrooms. And the play is talking about what that did to him and his life and his OCD. And that's coming up. The conversation we'll have after 1:30, after the 1:30 news here on 720 WGN. John, Williams Show. Justin Kaufman in for John, 312-981-7200. A lot of texters texting in about where they want to see a Chicago casino now that it has been approved for the first time. And I can't tell. We were joking about this, Steve Bertrand and I, on Mincing Rascals and other places. If you've been covering Chicago news, or just anyone who's studied Chicago news over the last 3 decades, the Chicago casino comes up all the time, and it never gets through.
Well, I remember Richard M. Brought it up, mm-hmm. and Governor Edgar killed it.
That was
well over 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's just amazing to me to think that here we are on this day, on this in June of 2019, and we're talking about where it's going to go. Where
I was at the event when it was this big unveil, because you know they talked about it forever before then, and Daley finally got on board, and you know they were talking about a giant complex, and it was a cause of great friction between the two. You know, Governor Edgar, I think it was Daley.
No, it was, yeah.
No, I know, but people started calling him Governor No, because he would, you know, say no to these grand ideas. And, you know, but Edgar looked at things. He was, you know, he's pretty conservative. He was also certainly fiscally conservative, and just wasn't ready to go pie in the sky.
It's great stories of political battles of the past, but that's no longer as a Chicago casino. Now Mayor Lightfoot says she's just going to commission a study and figure out where it's going to be. A lot of texters text in for the Thompson Center, State of Illinois building, and a lot of texters and calls for McCormick Place East, the great sort of iconic black building that's on the east side of Lakeshore Drive, not the new complex, but the old one. And then 630 kind of sums it up here. I'd love to see a Chicago casino in Las Vegas. There you go.
Right. Well, that's what we should do. Build a casino here and have the Las Vegas skyline like they do in Vegas, buildings around the world.
The New York, right?
Right.
There you go. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're going to switch gears here and talk about a play that's getting great reviews. It's in its final week down at the Greenhouse Theater in Lincoln Park. You can get tickets for The Mushroom Cure at greenhousetheater.org. Adam Strauss is here. Adam's story, this story is a one-man show. His background, he's a stand-up comedian, but he's also a performer. And after a life lived with OCD and mental illness, he found himself looking for a cure. And of course, the name of the show is The Mushroom Cure. And it seems like, and did he find it in mushrooms and psychedelics? And he's in studio right now. And to continue a conversation that John had on the show with Michael Pollan about psychedelics and it's how it's so misunderstood, but at the same time is being introduced to many more people for many different issues. Adam, great to have you here. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Justin.
So this idea obviously stems from your own life. It's an autobiographical show about your search for a cure.
Yeah. I mean, well, you sort of summed it up a little earlier. I heard you in the green room I'd been on all sorts of medications. Every possible medication indicated for severe OCD. I'd seen literally dozens of therapists, specialists, psychiatrists, psychologists, and nothing was helping. And I tried, the whole sort of standard menu of alternative treatments, yoga, acupuncture, meditation, various herbs, and the OCD was just getting worse and worse. And so in desperation, I was Googling for the, a thousandth time OCD cures. And there was a new result, which was the first at that time study of psychedelics for OCD. And it was a small pilot study. It was just 9 subjects. They gave them various doses of psilocybin, which is the main active compound in psychedelic mushrooms.
People may be familiar with that word because it's getting tossed around in politics right now. But go ahead.
Yeah, it's certainly getting right. It was decriminalized in Denver recently. There are various clinical trials that are underway right now. I was not familiar with that term at that point. I really had no psychedelic experience, but I had the gift of desperation. So I figured, well, what do I have to lose by trying this stuff? And that's sort of the opening scene of the show is when I find that study and resolve to try to cure myself.
How, when we talk about OCD, and a lot of people listening will be like, okay, I may have OCD, or I may have a different strain, or just severity of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for you, how crippling was your OCD? I mean, this is the kind of thing where you couldn't make decisions, regular decisions that a lot of people are, can do in a snap.
Yeah. So OCD, it's interesting because I think the sort of stereotypical conception of it is it's, you check the stove a lot or you wash your hands. And certainly that is common with OCD, but there are a lot of other variants. It's a very crafty sort of disorder, and it assumes all these different forms, and it can, even in one person, it can morph from one form to another. My major symptom or manifestation was decision making. So you can think of it the same way someone with, say, hand washing. They'll have an unwanted thought. The thought may be, I'm contaminated. They'll try to alleviate that thought by engaging in a behavior, washing their hands. And it works. For a little bit, the anxiety often will go down, but then it creeps back up, so they engage in the behavior again and again and again. And over time, that behavior, that excessive washing, just causes even more anxiety because their life is falling apart because, you know, they're spending 7 hours a day in the bathroom, etc. For me, it was decision-making. The unwanted thought was, I'm making the wrong decision, or I'm making a mistake, or I'm not doing it right. And the behavior that my brain sort of came up with was, well, change your decision. You've chosen A, you're feeling anxiety, why don't you try B? So I changed to B and I'd feel a little bit of relief and I'd be like, well, wait, no, now I'm feeling anxiety again. Let me go back to A. And it's ridiculous and, you know, sort of hilarious in a way, but, you know, it's often said life is about decisions. I would go a step further and say life actually is decisions. The act of being alive is just making a continuous stream of decisions.
That's absolutely true, right?
So yeah, if that breaks down, you asked how debilitating, it was completely paralyzing. It was hard to do anything, even the most basic functions, eating, bathing, going to work.
As a stand-up comedian and, you know, getting on stage in front of from thousands of people at different times, you know, that obviously has its own anxiety to it. But approaching your life and telling your story in front of audiences to try and find the funny in it, was that hard? Is that hard to do at first for you to say, okay, I'm going to put myself and put this mental disorder out there for people to laugh at?
You know, it wasn't that hard to find the humor in it because there was an awareness, maybe because, you know, I was a stand-up and you kind of train your brain. It's almost this algorithm that's always running in the background. Where's the humor here? And I was aware of how ridiculous the condition is. I mean, I think in some ways, and maybe some people would object to this, but I think you can laugh at anything. I think in some ways OCD is funnier than, say, depression. I mean, there are people, it's incredibly debilitating and agonizing, and I know that agony firsthand. So I'm not minimizing that. But to the outside, seeing people engage in these just ridiculous, repetitive behaviors, there's something comedic about that. And I guess I had a realization that because OCD is such a heavy, dark thing. I mean, I think it's changing now, but I think even relatively recently, there was sort of a general idea that, you know, OCD isn't as severe as depression, whereas in fact, the prognosis for real OCD is in some ways worse than depression.
Or the idea, like you said, the stereotype of, oh, so he's got to wash his hands all the time.
Big deal. Yeah, just get out of the bathroom, man. Just so having lived through OCD, I knew that if I was going to talk about this stuff, I didn't want to hold anything back. I wanted to be totally open and raw about it. But I also knew that that's pretty heavy. That's pretty dark. So it's sort of the old, a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. And I look at the laughter as, yeah, it would be a bit of a slog without that. But I think when you're laughing intermittently, you know, the way I look at it is I'm pretty confident saying anyone who comes to the show will laugh. But we also get quite a few audience members who do cry during the show. And I think they cry because it resonates with their own struggle or their family members' struggles. And I depict it in a very unguarded way.
And that's obviously the key to theater. And that's why people are raving about the show and why you won at the New York Fringe Festival. And is because this kind of mental disorder is very relatable. I mean, a lot of people have it. And like I said, there's a different severe.
Right. It's a spectrum. Yeah,
spectrum. But the idea of talking about it, it still falls a little bit under that taboo, that idea that this is my problem and I don't want to share it and I don't want to feel like I have this disorder because I got to go. So you kind of secretly go to the bathroom for just washing the hands kind of thing. But there is this closeted idea behind mental disorders like OCD.
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of shame, and I'm glad you brought that up because for me, one of the unanticipated benefits of doing the show is, you know, I didn't realize how much shame I had until the first time I did the show, you know, as often happens, well, your friends and family come. And a lot of them, I'd say most people had some awareness I had OCD, but very few. I would say no one really knew the extent of it. And it was terrifying, but also exhilarating, unburdening myself of that in front of these people who knew me. And because there is so much shame, because I think people with OCD are aware of how ridiculous and crazy this thing is. And that shame just, you know, it just adds to the burden.
In studio with me, Adam Strauss. He is the actor and stand-up comedian behind his own one-man show, The Mushroom Cure, which is playing at the Greenhouse Theater Center through Sunday. It's just this is the last week of it. Tickets are at greenhousetheater.org. We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk to you about the mushrooms, of course. I mean, this is the point of it. We set it up with the OCD, and we'll come back and we'll continue here on John Williams on 720 WGN. Adam Strauss is here. His show's called The Mushroom Cure. It's on stage till Sunday at the Greenhouse Theater. It was a big hit in New York. It was at the New York Fringe Festival. And The Mushroom Cure is about using psychedelic mushrooms to help counter Adam's OCD. It's a mental disorder that he had lived with his entire life and is searching for all sorts of remedies, whether it be the pharmaceutical kind or the alternative remedies, and hadn't found anything. And once you started to recognize, take us to the point where you recognized that maybe psychedelics, maybe mushrooms could be the key.
Yeah, so I found the study, as I mentioned, just Googling OCD cures, or as I say in the show, and it's actually true, I typed in OCD in Google auto-populated cures, because right, I Googled that, well, you could say obsessively. So when I found this study, you know, again, I didn't really have a little bit of experience in college, but not much. But there was a sense of, wow, I've tried everything else at this point, so what do I have to lose? And so, you know, there weren't any ongoing clinical trials at that point for OCD, so I knew I was going to have to do this kind of on my own in an underground fashion. And then this is one of the great coincidences of my life. And the show, I should say, it is completely true. I mean, I don't even change the names of the other people in the show. Very soon after reading that study and kind of being like, all right, I want to do this, but I don't know how to go about it, I started dating this woman, sort of a long-distance relationship. I actually met her at a comedy show in Times Square. She lived in Kansas. She was a psychologist, and I didn't learn this until it was maybe our second or third time hanging out. I actually asked her if she could get mushrooms. I figured she lived in a college town, sort of the natural sociological habitat of mushrooms, though they're ranging further into the mainstream now. And she revealed to me that she had inadvertently cured her own clinical depression with psychedelics. Mm. So a pretty remarkable coincidence, and I took that as sort of a green light from the universe.
What did you know about psychedelics at the time? Because there's a lot of stereotypes about that as well, but it is a drug and it does alter your state, and some people like it, some people don't.
Yeah. So, I mean, I knew very little about it. I mean, I knew sort of the popular conceptions, you know, Grateful Dead, Fish, that sort of thing, right. The 60s, Tune In, Drop Out, all of that. But so I started, you know, being obsessive. I'd say a lot of people with OCD, we tend to be researchers. So I started going down that rabbit hole and really learning everything I could about this stuff and, you know, best practices. And of course, this was all an underground body of knowledge. But one of the beautiful things about the internet is there's a lot of that out there, a lot of these message boards. So I certainly had trepidation. And I think that's kind of part of the value of psychedelics for conditions like OCD. OCD is all about control. And taking a psychedelic, the very act of ingesting a psychedelic is an act of surrender. You're basically letting go of control. You're saying, I'm going to allow something else in, and I don't really know what's going to happen. So that was certainly threatening and scary.
Was it scary? I mean, did that concept for you with OCD to let go, to give control, was hard?
Absolutely. But I think for me, the only thing scarier than that was continuing to live the way I was living at that point in life, which was just, you know, it really wasn't a life at all. I mean, I was so just imprisoned by the disorder. I mean, you know, there was rarely an hour where it wasn't dominating my life, you know, and to some extent I could keep up outward appearances, but that almost makes it more painful, you know? So I was really scared, but I really had tried everything else at that point. So ultimately it was kind of, well, what do I have to lose? Things aren't going to get worse.
So take us to that experience, and I'm sure it's in the show, but but this idea that, you know, that you were out of control. Now, I don't mean out of control, like the way he's out of control.
But that does happen out in the show. Yeah. Once I take the mushrooms, I don't want to get into any spoilers. Right.
But what happens? What happens? What is the psychedelic, what impact does it have on you?
Well, so the first time I tried, nothing, which is actually fairly common. I was on very high dose SSRIs, these antidepressant, anti-anxiety medications that for many people actually block the effects of psychedelics. So I had to get off of my antidepressants in order to effectively use these medications. When I did, though, I mean, the show is about 90 minutes long. if I were to include all the trips, it would be, you know, it would be an epic miniseries. There were a lot of experiences. Being obsessive and being, you know, driven, I kind of approached this sort of psychedelic task or journey in a somewhat obsessive way. I was going to do the right dose of the right drug in the right setting. And so there were quite a few trips, and most of them don't make it into the show. But the basic answer is what I found ultimately was I was looking for, as the title implies, this cure, this sort of silver bullet that was just going to take away the OCD. And I should be very clear, I did not find that. I still have OCD. It's significantly less debilitating. It's not debilitating generally, but it still can flare up. So where psychedelics came into play is I was, prior to doing psychedelics, I understood the idea that OCD, what makes it so sort of intractable, you kind of get trapped, is the harder you try to control it, the worse it gets. Yeah. So the way out of OCD is ultimately to surrender to the obsessions and the compulsive urges, which doesn't mean give in to them, but allow those unwanted thoughts, I'm making a mistake, I'm contaminated, is the stove on, let those thoughts be there without engaging in the action that you ordinarily would engage in to try to get rid of those thoughts, checking the stove, washing your hands, changing your decision. I understood that intellectually. That's all standard therapy. But acceptance is a tricky thing. I don't think understanding really does it. Acceptance to me, or surrender, is, it's not an intellectual exercise. It's more of a physical thing. It's really allowing it in. Or you can even say a spiritual thing, that leap of faith, that surrender.
And those are some of the tenets that are in yoga and other practices,
right,
of that,
yeah,
to let the body sort of be.
Absolutely. And I will say, not to get too off topic, once I had psychedelic experience, yoga and meditation became a lot more useful for me once I'd had that taste of surrender. And so, but it was, so I understood this from therapy. If I can surrender, if I can allow the obsessions to be there and just kind of sit with them, I'll be freed of the obligation to engage in these compulsive reversals that are destroying my life. But it was only on psychedelics that I actually had the visceral body experience of allowing those obsessions to be there and not fighting them. And once I had that experience on psychedelics, I gradually learned how to do that when I wasn't tripping.
Yeah. You know, did you see a way in which, when you were talking about mental disorders like OCD and how you can treat them with experimental, I don't know, maybe not experimental is not the word, but maybe unconventional ways like psychedelics, do you see a future in that? Do you see that more often the medical community and the scientific community and others will say, there is a positive in this thing that we have completely vilified? We've vilified mushrooms are on the level of every other serious
with,
drug.
Yeah, it's classed with heroin. Yeah, yeah.
But do you see a moment where there may be a different way we classify psychedelics?
Yeah, and I think that moment is coming shockingly quickly. I mean, MDMA for PTSD is likely going to be approved by the FDA within a year or two. Psilocybin is probably only a few years behind. And I think the reason we're seeing this, you know, suddenly this polar shift in public opinion and medical opinion is, I think part of it is the fact that there's a recognition that the conventional psychiatric medications, you know, these, they were hailed as wonder drugs 30 years ago, Prozac, et cetera.
Yeah.
The reality is they absolutely do help some people significantly, but many people they don't help. With OCD, the best data we have shows that 50% of people don't respond to medications, and the half who do only see about a 25% symptom reduction. Right. So I think there's an understanding that we need better treatments. And the fact is there's really nothing in the pipeline from pharmaceutical companies in terms of novel therapeutic compounds. This is our best shot. And the data, I mean, we are, for better or for worse, we're a very data-driven society. And the data we're seeing from these clinical trials of psychedelics, they blow anything coming out of the pharmaceutical firms out of the water.
You got 1 week to see the show, The Mushroom Cure, which is playing at the Greenhouse Theater Center in Lincoln Park. Tickets at greenhousetheater.org. It's playing till Sunday. Adam Strauss is an actor. He's a stand-up comedian. It's his story about how he found psychedelics to help him with OCD. Adam, great to meet you. Great to have you in studio. And good luck with the last week of the show and your continued career.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks for having me, Justin.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
Actually, Justin Kaufman in for John, but I like this music. There it is. Listen to that. Saxophone. That's what it is. It's saxophone. Someone on the text said it was a saxophone. But the end, the little honk there, the little duck honk at the end, that's a saxophone. So I think we got it, Elif. That was strong. Texter also pointed out we're going to talk about the MLB draft coming up at 2:30 with Kevin Powell. And I was talking about how the White Sox yesterday made history. It was the first time in MLB history that a right-handed first baseman was picked in the top five picks of the MLB draft. Because most of the time, there's a bias. They like the left-handers at first base, and it has to do with the ability to tag and maybe the gloves. I don't know. Something like that. But the White Sox have been an anomaly. They have a history of right-handed first basemen, including the all-star first baseman right now, Jose Abreu. And you think about Paulie Konerko. And I forgot, and I should be taken off the air, and I should be punished. I should be suspended for 2 weeks. The Hall of Fame first baseman for the Chicago White Sox, Frank Thomas was the first baseman who was right-handed. So the White Sox have gone against the trend of left-handed first basemen for quite some time. So, you know what? I like the idea that they went with a right-hander. They have their own tradition to uphold. So we'll talk about that coming up after the 2:30 news. Well, this is an interesting stat. So far in Illinois this year, 2019, four law enforcement officers have lost their lives. Now, if you think about that, and you go back to 2018, that was the total number. And the idea that we have seen more and more accidents, whether it be on the roadways or just law enforcement officers losing their lives in the line of duty, it's something to be concerned about. It's got a lot of ink in the last 6 months, of course. And the Chicago Police Memorial Foundation and and my guest who's coming up have done a lot to keep it in the news and to make sure that we're not forgetting about some of the issues that are around police and making sure that funds are raised for the families and making sure we don't forget. Phil Klein, the former Chicago Police Superintendent, is also the executive director of the Chicago Police Memorial Foundation. He joins me in the studio. Phil, great to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for the invite, Justin. Appreciate it.
You know, we were just talking before he came on just about I covered a lot of the news back in the 2000s and in the 90s, and you were the superintendent at the time. But, you know, to see that kind of stat, before we get into what you're doing with the lotto to raise awareness, to see a stat where you're seeing just in the first couple months fallen officers at the same level as a year's worth. What does that mean? What does that mean to you?
Well, it's scary. Last year, Chicago had four officers that were killed in line of duty. Two were shot to death, and then two were hit by a train. And to see the state troopers are getting with accidents. And I think that's one of the most dangerous things for them to do is do a traffic stop on the expressway with people going by at 70 miles an hour.
Every time you see it, another story comes out about it, it is hard to fathom. It makes sense only because it's a very dangerous thing to do. There's obviously such high danger with a car speeding by, but there's something about the idea that we were all taught. I was taught at 16 years old on a drive that if you see a squad car with the lights on, that you have to move over or slow down. And that seems to be forgotten by some of these drivers.
I mean, that's Scott's Law right there. What you just said is you either got to move over one lane and leave an empty lane between you and the squad car, or you have to slow down if you can't safely move over a lane.
For you, you're looking to raise funds, and you've joined in with the Illinois Lottery Association, and talk about what you're doing here. This is a lotto ticket that the proceeds from this one lotto ticket actually go to the Memorial Foundation and to fallen officers' families.
Yeah, it's a great thing. It was passed and signed by the governor earlier this year. May 7th, we had a rollout of the tickets, and on May 13th was a ceremony held at Gold Star Park. The proceeds are shared by, of course, the lottery gets 75%, and then the other 25% is cut up between the Chicago Police Memorial Foundation, the Illinois State Police Memorial, and the Springfield Police Memorial, which covers all the rest of the towns in Illinois. So every police department benefits from this. And people are going to play the lottery anyway, so why not do something and support the cops at the same time?
Yeah. Do you feel like there's that you know, Illinois is obviously we're just talking about the accidents and the fallen officers. We've seen a lot in the last 2 years. Do you see from the Memorial Foundation that people get behind this cause and are giving to the charity, are supporting the families and really stepping up to help the Chicago and the Illinois police?
Absolutely. I mean, starting with after Commander Brower was shot and killed in Duluth last year. People just came out and donated and made sure that we have the money. Because we picked up 8 kids last year that we're going to be responsible for paying for their education from preschool through grad school. Mm-hmm. And our goal is they graduate with no debt at all. And for other parents who are paying, they understand what a big thing that is. But that's...
That's the goal for the families.
For us, for the families, is we'll make sure that your child graduates with no debt.
Where's that goal come from? I mean, as you get the Memorial Foundation and years and decades of supporting the families of fallen officers, that seems to be the most important thing?
Yeah, I mean, I always say if you could have talked to any one of these cops on their last day and said, listen, you're not going to go home today, what do you want us to do? It would be take care of my family, mm-hmm. and that's what we're doing.
Phil, this is an interesting time. We have a new mayor in the city of Chicago, and you've worked with mayors in the city and when you were at the police department. There's going to be a lot made of the police contract that's coming up. There's going to be a lot made of just the relationship between not just the police and the community, but the police and City Hall. When the new mayor takes office and there's the police and there's City Hall and there's been a lot of talk about reform, everyone gets a little antsy. Do you feel that? Is there tension right now between the police and our politicians?
I think it's the unknown, too. That's the thing is we don't know what this mayor is going to do, who's going to be the next superintendent after Eddie Johnson, and what direction they want this department to go in. And cops will do their job out there, but you got to let them know what you want, and then you got to back them.
When you were police superintendent, there's so many things that we see that you mentioned Superintendent Johnson, but there will be times like this weekend where you'll see an inordinate amount of shootings in a weekend, 50 plus or something like that. And ultimately, someone is looking to take responsibility for that. And a lot of times it's on the superintendent's shoulders. Is that fair?
No. But, I mean, that's just the way it is. It's like a baseball team that's losing. The manager is responsible. It's the same thing here. If shootings are up, homicides are up, the superintendent's going to have to take the jacket for it.
From your vantage point of a lifetime and a career in law enforcement, why do we continue to see these kind of numbers? What is it about Chicago right now that we have all this emphasis and all of this action that is on homicides and gun violence, yet the numbers stay the same?
Well, it's not just the police. It's got to be other law enforcement parts to the criminal justice system. And that includes the courts and the state's attorney's office. And I don't think you're seeing that from the state's attorney's office right now. I mean, we've got to put bad guys in jail and keep them in jail. That's the whole idea. And if it's not being done, then they're going to come back and be repeat as offenders.
And you see that over and over and over, and that's obviously becoming a point of contention. But they're also on the flip side to say that, there's a lot of people committing crime. So if you continually put them in jail and they continually come out, maybe because of where they live and impoverished communities, that it's just a vicious cycle and it continues to create. So putting them in county, putting them in jail, it's not changing the fact that they're going to come out and commit crime.
But if you put a shooter in jail, he's not going to shoot anybody while he's in jail. And that's our feelings is let's go after the bad guys and let's keep them locked up.
Yeah. Phil Klein, the former police superintendent for the city of Chicago, is here. He, of course, is talking about how to raise money for some of the families of fallen officers. You can go to get this actual police ticket, lotto ticket that is available right now. He's also, of course, the executive director over at the Chicago Police Memorial Foundation. We'll take a quick break. Come back more with Phil Klein. Stay with us. Former Chicago Police Superintendent Phil Klein is in studio. We're talking about police and policing here on John Williams Show, 312-981-7200. 773 says the police are facing a no-win situation. It's a fact that the criminals are let go and puts the blame squarely on the state's attorney. But the question I have here is that the state's attorney, and I know there's a lot of that law enforcement is really putting a push on state's attorney. But she ran on this idea, and it seems like the voters of Cook County resoundingly voted for her to do this sort of reform of political, of the state's attorney's office, and to think about how we do restorative justice and other things as opposed to just putting kids in jail. So how do you reconcile that? I mean, there's the idea that you were talking about, but this idea that there is this need to change the way the criminal justice system works in general.
Well, there's got to be a dialogue between the state's attorney and the police, mm-hmm. and they've got to come to an agreement. And sure, do we want young kids that did something in a school being locked up? No. But do we want a guy that's out here shooting and sticking up people and selling dope? Yes, we want him locked up. So there's that middle ground they have to find and work with that.
We've seen a couple of instances in the last couple of weeks of pretty violent crimes perpetrated by younger kids. We're talking like 15, 14 years old. And you're seeing it, whether it be carjackings or armed robberies, things where that. And I guess the question I have for you is, you're seeing, is that just a criminal underworld and gangs in Chicago being savvy to know that the rules that apply to juveniles are different than apply to adults? Why are 14 or 15-year-old kids running around with guns being able to stick people up nilly-willy?
In most cases, you hit it right on the head. The gangs know that a 14 and 15-year-old is going to have a much different day in court than a 17, 18, 19-year-old hard gangbanger's done time in the penitentiary. So they'll use that, and they'll also make the kids do something like that to join the gang. Hey, if you want to join the gang, you got to go carjack somebody.
Phil, you know, your vantage point of having to battle gangs and battle City of Chicago crime, both from your position where you're at now, but also, you know, as a Chicago police superintendent, crime commission, all the way down the line. How has it changed? Because I've heard this story told to me by people who might be at the university level or other people who might be investigating Chicago crime, that gangs have changed, that we no longer have these hierarchies, that we no longer have the same sort of structures that may have been in place when you were superintendent, that's sort of splintered off, and now these kids are almost in the wild, wild west.
Well, they call them cliques now. In other words, you could have five different cliques in a two-block area, and they may be from the same gang or they may be different gangs. And there's no longer, they're not shooting each other because they're being ordered to from the top. This is just on their own they're doing it, and they think it's cool to do it. And there's nobody in the penitentiary, no godfather, that's telling the gangs, okay, cool, do right, this, and right. You're going to give 100% to me, and none of that stuff happens. In fact, when those guys come back to the street, those kids were babies when these guys went away. They'll end up shooting them rather than pay them a tribute.
How hard does that make it for police, for intel, for relationships when you're not dealing with a structure? Instead, you're dealing with just straight up lawlessness.
It's a lot harder to enforce the laws against that, because when you had a higher hierarchy in the gang, you got informants, you got somebody up there that was telling you, here's the word that's coming down. You were able to prevent stuff. When these things are all on the spur of the moment and they walk down the street and somebody looks at them the wrong way and they fire, it's much harder to solve those type of crimes.
It makes the job of police officer much harder, and I would assume, obviously, with the way that policing has changed, because there isn't this big monolith, this idea of a gang that you're chasing. Instead, you're chasing the 14 and 15-year-old kid. You can kind of understand why they're is this discord between communities and police, because there no longer is this, this regulated way to go about it. It's almost like I think about war zones, where when there's war is not fought the way war has been fought in the past. We saw that in the history of the United States of America, whether it be Vietnam or there are Revolutionary War. It becomes more difficult to fight crime when the crime has changed. And therefore, it's got to make the job of the beat cop, the person who's on the street in some of these affected areas, almost impossible.
It is, and the beat cop has to learn who's the good kids in the neighborhood, who's the bad kids in the neighborhood, and treat them accordingly. I think you're seeing a lot less stops by the police today, and that's equaling more guns on the street, because when the cops were stopping kids and getting guns off of them, then the word got out there, hey, be careful, the cops are out stopping people tonight, stopping gangbangers tonight. You don't have that now.
Guns is a great point. You know, there was some gun control measures that were going through Springfield in this last session. They didn't get through. If you listen to any politician talk, they'll talk about the flow of guns coming in from the state of Indiana and other places that have lax gun restrictions has a direct impact on what's happening in Chicago. Do you see it that way from your perch?
Well, it used to be half of our guns came from suburban gun shops and the other half came from Indiana and Mississippi. So they are right. Those are the two states that a lot of kids from here would go down there, find somebody down there to buy five guns and then come back up north with them. The days of kids breaking into a house and getting a gun and using that as their crime. They buy the best guns they have. They all have Glocks and much higher power rifles to use out on the street. So
I guess, you know, for I think about it, and it, how do you stop it? Is it just trying to cooperate with the governments and the lawmakers to change the gun laws? How do police stop this flow? Because I hear different stories that it's easier to get a gun on the street than say a drug, than a marijuana, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at best practices in other towns and other states and see what they're doing and who's having success and adopt those things here. That's what we did when I was superintendent. We had a lot of success by doing that.
Phil, my last question before I let you go, just the police reform, we're talking about the consent decree and Mayor Lightfoot is behind the consent decree and this concept of a reform Chicago Police Department. Where do you stand on police reform as it's sort of playing out in the courts, the federal courts right now?
Well, I think you have to look at what parts of the reform. If the reform means more training and best practices and things like that, I'm all for it. If it's going to handcuff the police, then I'm going to be against it.
Yeah. Phil Klein, the former Chicago Police Superintendent, and of course he is the Executive Director at the Chicago Police Memorial Foundation. We were talking about the lotto ticket, partnering with the lotto to have one ticket that you can get that's the Police Memorial Foundation ticket that gives to the 100% of the proceeds to not just your foundation but others that help with families of fallen officers. Where can we find out more info about that?
Go to cpdmemorial.org, and like you said, this lottery ticket is for the whole state. It's not just for the Chicago police. It's for the whole state. And Father's Day is coming up. What a great gift.
There you go. Phil, great to see you. Thanks for coming
in. Nice seeing you, Justin.
All right, we'll go straight to the news here. We come back, we'll talk with Kevin Powell about the White Sox fascination with the right-handed first baseman. It's part of our legacy. This is the wrong AC/DC song. If you
lost Back in Black.
Well, Back in Black is good. It's fine. It's in the family. But it's Thunderstruck that the Sox come out to.
Oh, right.
That one. Yeah.
Thunderstruck.
They're both really good songs.
Which I have to say, I had a Steve Bertrand, I had this grandiose idea I was going to go to like 25 games. I was going to just be a White Sox. I was going to be the new Bill Veeck out there just watching every White Sox game. That didn't happen. But the game I did, one of the games I went and I brought a friend of mine, and I was like, all right, you got to see the Thunderstruck. You've never seen Thunderstruck when they come out of the dugout? Thunderstruck? Oh, it's the best, man. They get the whole crowd gets
Thunder!
Yeah, Thunder! And I don't know if it was some sort of, maybe I think that night was some sort of country music night or Star Wars night. I forgot what it was.
Hell
one of those.
Aw.
And they didn't do it.
I haven't seen
That's
it yet
shame.
This year either.
So I think it's limited. Like they do it once in a while. Yeah, it really, I want it to be there. Like
I think I'm used to it every game.
Right. It reminds me, I don't know, it reminds me of Konerko and Pierzynski and the White Sox of
You'll
the 2000s.
There.
Yeah, just more than a Journey song ever will. That Journey song doesn't mean anything to me, but the Don't Stop Believing, that was marketed garbage. But the Thunderstruck, you're like, you're at the game, you're like.
Oh, yeah, and the board would have like
yes,
the lightning strikes mixed
yes.
in with plays.
And they
oh,
did
man.
The and they did the fireworks.
Good stuff. It was, I was always pumped up.
Hmm. Kevin Powell, what do you have any intel?
I don't have any intel. I also remember that was a drinking game. Every time you hear thunder, you take a sip.
Well, if you do it in a circle, you have to chug until thunder is spoken again, and then the next person goes.
I love
same
that.
Thing.
We should play it right now. You guys in?
Gosh, I missed that. I missed that craze, the thunder craze drinking game.
Solid just drinking right. game.
That's such a shame when you get somebody prepared for something that they're going to see or hear mm-hmm. like that, and then you're almost like, you shouldn't be embarrassed because it's not your
right.
fault. You didn't do it. But
well, it was my friend from L.A., Adam, and he was back in town this winter. You like this. All you guys are like this. But then I took him to the Blackhawks game, and they don't disappoint when it comes to the national anthem. It's probably the best sporting experience and most surreal sporting experience to watch how everyone cheers through the national anthem at the United Center.
If you don't get goosebumps, you don't
right.
have a soul.
And he's in L.A., so he's L.A. Kings guy, and he was dumbfounded. He's never been to a sporting event where he was looking at me like, what's happening? But it is. It is a traditional, a very unique thing that happens in Chicago. So that, at least they go with that every time. I would like the White Sox to bring Thunder back, do it every single night. Can you make that happen, Kev Powell?
I think I can. And it's interesting you bring that up, because now that you mention it, it's, now that I think, I don't think I've heard it much at the ballpark this year.
Yeah, I haven't seen it once, and yeah. I've been to at least 8 games already.
Well, Kev, and I'm, you know me to be a White Sox fan, I was looking at the schedule coming up here in June.
Mm-hmm.
It is nasty.
Mm-hmm.
It is not going to be an easy trek for the White Sox to continue this surge, because they go on the road to play Boston. I think the Cubs, right? They're at Wrigley.
Yep.
And they also play the Texas Rangers. And they're also at home. They got 4 at home against the Yankees and 3 at home against the Twins. That's June.
They've got 2 against the Nationals. Nationals not having a great
year.
Yeah,
let's get those National games.
And
then the
Royals this weekend, which if you would have told me that we were anticipating a Royals-Sox game June 7th and being very excited about it.
Or excited because we want to see him fight.
I mean, it's changed. It really has changed what has happened with Tim Anderson.
So to update everybody, there is actual bad blood between the White Sox and the Royals, because Tim Anderson, the great shortstop for the White Sox,
like an all-star,
he likes to flip his bat, and he did so in dramatic fashion, and the traditionalists over there in Kansas City.
Well, it's not even just Kansas City, it's just baseball as a whole. It's not the most progressive thinking sport, Justin. I don't know if you noticed that. Earlier in the year, Tim Anderson at homer, he flipped his bat. I thought it was cool. And then his next at-bat, the Royals threw at him, pegged him, Brad Keller.
Right.
And, benches cleared, all those sorts of things. And then last week, I think it was last week, the Royals pitcher actually, I don't think it was intentional, actually.
It was a weird spot in the game
Wednesday,
to do
right?
it.
It was Wednesday, right? Wednesday's game.
Yeah. And even the Sox said after the game, we don't think it was a changeup. Nobody throws a change. If you're trying to hit a guy, you're not throwing a changeup, throwing a fastball.
Yeah.
And it was just a bad throw, and it caught the tip of his helmet, and the pitcher for the Royals got tossed, and the Royals were not happy about it, which I can understand, because he wasn't actually trying to throw at Tim Anderson. And if that had happened to any other Sox player, that he wouldn't have got thrown out of the game. But you can make the case that, well, the Royals did this to themselves, right? I mean, they did that earlier in the year when they obviously did throw at Tim Anderson.
Yeah, they've set up a precedent. And it doesn't help that both of the locker rooms do not hide their disdain for the other squad. I mean,
after the game, we asked Tim Anderson about it. He goes, he's straight up. He's like, I don't like him. I don't like the Royals. I hope we whoop them every time we play them.
You know, it's not a bad thing to have for a cellar-dweller team like the Royals, because otherwise you'd be like, well, what's the point?
That's what I mean. Yeah, Sox-Royals, and the Sox are playing. The Royals are in the bottom of the AL Central, but this is going to be an interesting weekend in Kansas City.
How perfect is it that both Chicago teams have a rivalry with both Missouri teams, and it's the Southside team against the Missouri Southside team?
Think about that. Right.
It's awesome. I love it.
Well, the Chicago White Sox made history yesterday with the MLB draft. In a very strange way, but they were the first team to take in the top 5 picks of the MLB draft a right-handed first baseman.
Mm-hmm.
This is a big deal. Tell us a little bit, Kevin, about Andrew Vaughn.
Andrew Vaughn this past year, Justin, batted .381, 14 doubles, 15 homers, 50 RBI. He had a .544 on base percentage, which is ridiculous. He's a 2018 Golden Spikes Award winner, which is given to the best amateur baseball player in the country every year. Players who have won that award: Chris Bryant, Bryce Harper, Buster Posey. A lot of great baseball players have won that award. Andrew Vaughn is basically, they described him as a straight pure hitter. And I guess if there are question marks, it's defensively. He's a first baseman out of Cal, but some have said this is the best pure hitting prospect in the draft in the past 10 years. So he's I watched some highlights of him last night. He's not a huge first baseman. You normally think big, right? 6'2", 6'3", 250 pound slugger. He's 6'2", 215, not small, but a little undersized for first base. But the guy's a straight hitter, and the Sox are thrilled about him. And a lot of the scouts that were ranking this and doing mock drafts and those sorts of things had him as the best hitter in the draft. So I think the Sox got a good one in Andrew
Vaughn.
Okay,
so let me ask you this, and I don't have the answer to this, but there seems to be, it might be part of back to that old baseball tradition, but there seems to be almost an unwritten rule that the first baseman needs to be left-handed. Now, I get that he's closer to the tag on the pickoff play, But other than that, is there any sort of emphasis or I guess advantage to being left-handed and playing first base?
I think it's more defensively. I mean, the Sox current first baseman is a righty in Jose Abreu, mm-hmm. and he's one of the best first basemen in the American League, if not the best. So I wouldn't overreact if the fact that he's a right. You know, there are some people thinking maybe he could eventually end up at third base. We'll see. Again, defensively is really kind of, if there are question marks about his game, it is his game defensively. Yeah. But you know, I wouldn't overthink the whole righty component of it all.
It's fascinating too, because we were just kind of coming to, you know, we were just talking about it on the show today. But if you think about the history of the Chicago White Sox, at least recent memory. The first basemen they've had, Jose Abreu, you just mentioned, right-hander. The one that was the big-timer before Jose was Paul Konerko, mm-hmm. right-hander. Before Paul Konerko, the Hall of Fame first baseman, Frank Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
So the White Sox have been outliers in the way that in the last 20 years, they've all been right-handed first basemen.
They have. That's a good point. And I think for the White Sox, who are loaded in the farm system, they didn't really necessarily have a top first baseman prospect. And look, Jose Abreu is in a final year of his contract. There's some people saying, well, should they trade him and get value for him? I don't think they should trade him. I think they should actually extend him. I don't know how, 2-3 years. He's 32 years old, but he's clearly not slowing down. He's having a pretty good year. So you're right. I mean, they do have a long list of great first basemen in the organization.
Yeah, it's funny too, because even if you're fat, because it's funny to hear yesterday, these guys, all of the pundits saying, well, you know, this guy, Andrew Vaughn, he has a fast track to the majors. He's got the skills. He could be an immediate impact. He'd be ready for the majors. But it's baseball. Mm. It took Mike Trout 2 years. You know, like right. At a certain point, what is fast in baseball? I mean, you could have Jose Abreu until he's 35 and then turn it over to Andrew Vaughn.
Well, that's the thing, too, with the draft is, you know, I think especially if you have the third pick in the draft, it's not necessarily draft for need in baseball quite like it is in the NFL, where if you need a quarterback, there's no questions about it. You take a quarterback. You draft for need in the NFL more than you do in baseball because it is such a journey to get to the big leagues, right? I mean, yeah. Andrew Vaughn could be in the majors in 2 years. He could be in the majors in 4 years. You just don't really know. It's so tough to get to the big league level. So I think the Sox just took the best player available at, you know, with the third pick after the top two went, and it's Andrew Vaughn. So, you know, I think when you have the third pick, you have that luxury. If it's a little different, I think if you're down in the you know, the 25th pick or the 30th pick, yeah. you might draft a little bit more towards need, where if you have a top three pick, you're just drafting the best player available. And you know, even if you do have Jose Abreu for the next few years, I mean, look, the Cubs at one point had Javi Baez, Addison Russell, and Gleyber Torres all in the system at the same time. And what did they do with Torres? They got Aroldis Chapman for him in that Yankees trade, and they won the World Series. So you can never have too much talent. I mean, that's, you know, that's the beauty of baseball. You have all these farm systems. You have the farm system in place. You have four teams below your big league club where you can stock talent, develop talent. So even if I'm not saying he's potentially a trade candidate. I'm just saying that you can never have too much talent. And even if you do have Jose Abreu at first base, you find a way to get the guy in, or it is a trade asset at some point.
Absolutely. It's a great way to look at it, that in 2 years' time they could be in the playoff hunt and they need an Aroldis Chapman and they give up this kid. Listen, this is 2017. Even if you're a baseball fan, 2017 draft. Just looked it up while Kevin was talking. Wikipedia, right? These are the players that won the top five.
You probably won't even recognize
Royce
most
Lewis,
of them.
Yeah. Hunter Green, Mackenzie Gore, Brendan McKay, Kyle Wright.
Right.
If you keep going all the way down to the 27 teams that are in first round selection in 2017, none of them are on a MLB roster right now. And it just goes to show you that's 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Most players don't make it to the big leagues. I mean, if you land. Currently, they've drafted six players because the rounds 3 through 10 are today, and then they finish up. I guess they just finished all of it up tonight. But if you look at really at any draft, let's just say 95% of them are not going to make the big leagues.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. I mean, I could go. It's amazing.
Do you get hyped for the draft, Justin? Because the MLB draft does not have this sort of lure that the NFL draft or the NBA draft.
I never cared, and obviously, in the last couple of years, I paid more attention to both the White Sox and the Cubs because you're seeing these superstars that are coming up. Javi Baez comes to mind, but I even go further back. I mean, here's 2016, Mickey Moniak, Oh, the Philadelphia Phillies, an outfielder. Mickey Moniak, I've never heard his name. Nick Senzel plays. He's the number two pick for the Reds. This was his, he's a rookie. And then you've got Riley Pint from the Colorado Rockies. Corey Ray from the Brewers. A.J. Puck, who's was the well-known name, Oakland A's. Braxton Garrett. Cal Quant. Have you heard any of these names, Elif? I've never heard of any of these names. Not even like on your, if I play fantasy baseball and I'm like, who's in the minors? These guys are not there. You know what I mean? Like if you're in the fantasy baseball and you're like, oh, I'm paying attention to Matt Manning in Detroit. No, I'm not. Mm-hmm. But that's 3 years ago.
Yeah.
So you're right. The idea that MLB draft, most of these players don't make it. And if they do, you don't start seeing these prospects for 4 years.
Right.
So for as many people who are thinking that Andrew Vaughn is a replacement for Jose Abreu, think again. Because my guess would be Jose Abreu would be shipped for trade pieces, and we would have a journeyman for 2 years until Andrew Vaughn is ready in 3 to 4 years. That's crazy. You're right. You think about basketball or football, expect those rookies to play right now.
Yeah. I mean, especially basketball. I mean, basketball, you could draft a guy that could change a franchise within a year. I mean,
right.
This is baseball. You know, and the Kyler Murray situation, he was the Heisman winner out of Oklahoma, who actually was drafted by the Athletics. In last year's draft, and the Athletics were basically begging him to stay with baseball, to stick with baseball. Kyler Murray decided to go in the draft. He was a top overall pick. If Kyler Murray decided to go to the Athletics and play baseball, no one would be talking about Kyler Murray, at least outside of the baseball world, for the next, who knows? I mean, who knows if it's just so tough to get there. Kyler Murray now is
household name.
Is a household name. He's gonna, you know, we're gonna be talking about Kyler Murray all next year.
Now the big trade off is that he gets guaranteed contracts and he gets to jog a little bit as opposed to getting his brains beat in.
He's still got a massive contract. That's true. Quarterbacks barely get hit anymore.
Kyler Murray is like, yeah, you could play in the majors. We'll give you a 12-year deal for $300 million, or we'll give you 2 years and you can get 16 concussions.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you'll be on the Wheaties box a lot faster.
Be in the Wheaties box a lot faster. And like I said, a quarterback barely gets hit anymore.
He's a runner, though.
The White Sox today drafted a guy named James Beard.
Oh, wow.
He's an award winner in his own way.
He's a chef.
He's a chef. Fastest player in the draft, center fielder, comparisons to Billy Hamilton.
Okay.
He's on the Royals now. If you've seen Billy Hamilton play, he is unbelievably fast. And when he gets on the base paths, he is dangerous.
There you go. All right, well, we'll pay attention. Of course, they got the Nationals in Washington. They get the Steven Strasburg tonight.
They do.
So that's going to be a tough draw, but the White Sox are hot, so we'll see what happens. All right, thanks, Kev. We'll take a quick break, and we'll come back here more with John Williams coming up. Rowan Anna, stay with us. All right, let's bring Wayne in. Wayne's got a reason for left-handed first baseman. He's on the line. Wayne, why does the Major League Baseball stick with the left-handed first baseman?
Well, it's not that they stick with it, Jonathan. It's because they can stretch further. With their left foot on the bag, their body is facing the infield, and their right hand with the glove is facing the ball. So they can stretch a lot further that way, and they're facing the infield.
But if you're talking about a right-handed batter who can slug as much as a left-handed batter, what are we talking about? Inches here? Milliseconds in terms of a stretch of a right-handed versus a left-hander? You know what I mean?
It's not a question I can answer, but it's been that way since baseball first started.
No, right.
Now, that being said, Ernie Banks was one of the greatest first basemen the Cubs ever had, but the reason they moved him from shortstop to first base in 1958 was because he was such a fantastic hitter.
Yeah.
And they wanted to save his legs playing in shortstop, so they moved him to first base.
Great.
So you're going to find a lot of great hitters playing first base who weren't the best glove men.
Right. That's where you kind of – that's like me in 16-inch softball. That's where you put me because I become less mobile as I get up there in my age. So they keep me around the first base I can catch, but, you know, I'm not going to be running all over the place. So.
Right. And the only time you're playing with a glove in softball is if you're playing an ASA tournament, I'm guessing.
Yeah. There you go. Thanks, Wayne. I appreciate it, buddy. All right. There we go. 708 says Corey Ray. You just mentioned Corey Ray, the Milwaukee Brewers draft pick from 2016. Chicago kid. He was part of the White Sox youth program. Yeah. There you go. You learn something new every day. Elif, does this give you a better understanding of the traditions and the mechanics of Major League Baseball?
A little, I guess. I learned something new today, so.
Are you a baseball fan, Elif?
Yeah. I don't know. What am I supposed to say? I can't lie. I'm a terrible liar, first of all.
I'm not going to be offended if you're not.
Why is that a bad thing?
Because we're the home of the White Sox.
Oh. So. I think it's okay if you're not a baseball fan. The White Sox will forgive us.
I think it'd be different if it was like, it's time for Elif Sports Corner. And there was a theme song, and you were like, and then you divulged that you didn't like sports.
That would be really. Yeah.
Are you a hockey fan? We're also the home of the Chicago Blackhawks.
You know who I'm not a fan of? You know, I love the Blackhawks. Kev, I complain about this on my podcast, Lower Wacker Live, which you can get every day. I am just not, I cannot get into the Stanley Cup final. And I think it has to do with St. Louis and Boston, both teams that I just have no interest in. And it might just be being a Blackhawks fan, but I want it to be over now.
It's a lose-lose for Chicago because it's the Blues, obviously. Yeah. And then Boston, who wants to see him winning the championship? Now, we went out last night. And Lauren was just about as vocal as she is during a Blackhawks game because she is vehemently against the St. Louis Blues.
She's against it. Okay.
They are not allowed to win a Stanley Cup.
I agree with you.
But the series has been so exciting. And so any hockey fan in general, I would think, has been enjoying this final series.
You got to get to watching it. That's the problem. I cannot watch. When I see that blue and that yellow, the Blues jersey, and then also the black and the yellow, the sweater of the Bruins. I'm just like, nope.
Which is fair, but then you just got to watch them just like take each other out, and there's like blood being strewn everywhere. It's a very violent, but very good series.
Oh, okay. We'll pay attention to that. All right, so I'm not in tomorrow. Someone's in, I don't know who's in, but John's back on Thursday. Extension 720 tomorrow night. It's a very, very fun show. We have, this is Street Festival time, Elif. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different awesome bands that you can go see play on the streets. And a lot of people just don't have access to it. They don't have time to get out there. So what we've done in Extension 720 has created almost like our own street festival. We have all live music tomorrow night. There's seven different bands, all different styles, from rock to
disco,
bluegrass to soul to
opera?
Blues, no opera,
oh.
To bagpipes. There's bagpipers. And there is, but my favorite, Che Apalache is one of the bands. They are from Argentina. They're from Buenos Aires, but they play bluegrass.
Huh.
And because the main guy grew up in North Carolina, and because of that, he went down to Buenos Aires and he was teaching banjo. And now they've become the sort of go-to banjo band in South America. And they'll be on Extension 720 playing tomorrow night.
That sounds awesome.
It's fun. It's like, so you don't have to deal with like hot shoulder to shoulder crowds sitting on a curb, eating a hot dog next to the garbage can, like a Chicago street festival. You can just enjoy it in the comfort of your home tomorrow night, starting at 7 o'clock.